Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who's a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He served as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, and special U.S. coordinator for Mediterranean Trade, Investment, and Security Affairs. He serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense's Special Operations Command and as advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. He has a new article in the Huffington Post, Obama's Syrian Red Line is No Red Light to Hezbollah or Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Ginsburg.
Thank you to be with you.
And you described the situation in Syria as a kind of witch's brew with Hezbollah, the Al-Quds Revolutionary Guard Corps from Iran, and Al-Qaeda all kind of circling around the soon-to-be carcass of the Assad clan. We have so little control, I guess, because we're you know, the Russians and the Chinese are basically screaming now that this whole red line that the president announced the other day about chemical weapons and their possible use is a pretext for U.S. intervention. Do you think that this is there's any likelihood of any U.S. intervention?
It's a tough question because the president has indicated in his press conference the other day that there are contingency plans for military intervention if indeed that red line that he indicated is crossed by the regime, that is a regime that would deploy or otherwise provide WMD to against its adversaries or provide it to supporters. And we have to remember that Syria probably has the largest stockpile of chemical and biological weapons than any other country besides Iran in the Middle East.
So is there a possible kind of Gotterdammerung situation here as the Assad's fall and more defectors seem to indicate, at least that's what they're saying, that the regime is cracking from within? You have mentioned in your Huffington Post article, Ambassador Ginsburg, that they're actually the brother, the enforcer, Maha, the younger brother who runs the Republican Guard, may have lost his leg in the Damascus blast that killed their brother-in-law, and that he possibly recently initialed a secret agreement with Iran and Hezbollah to have them bring in some forces. And there's a possibility, of course, of what might happen with the chemical arsenals that they have. So do you think, I'm just thinking back to the first war against Iraq, when Saddam Hussein used Scud missiles, albeit with conventional warheads, on Israel to bring Israel into that war to break up the coalition that President George H.W. Bush had put together. Is there a possibility that Assad might use his Scuds to do the same, to bring Israel in, to save himself at the last minute, to distract the Arab world from the fact that he's a kind of pariah?
You know, Ian, you would be a very good Situation Room war game strategist by that question. And I don't think that anyone, including me, honestly, have given that a lot of thought. Is it conceivable when a regime and a dictatorial regime is prepared to fight to the last person? And since this regime essentially has come to the conclusion that it's going to take every last Syrian down with it, if it's possible, even if it has to, in effect, abandon most of the Syrian countryside. You can't put anything past this crew. This family has played for keeps ever since 1967, when the regime came to power. This is a regime that plays by Iranian rules. It doesn't play by anyone else's rules. The irony of it is that you have an ophthalmologist trained in London, who everyone had great expectations would be a reformer, who's turned out to be as ruthless as his father, so the apple doesn't fall from the tree, far from the tree.
So in terms of the witch's brew that you write about in your Huffington Post article, Ambassador Ginsburg, Obama's Syrian red line is no red light for Hezbollah or Iran. What's the bottom line message there?
The bottom line is that from a strategic perspective, both Hezbollah, which is dependent on Syria for providing it access to continued arms from Iran, and Iran, which considers Syria to be its most important client state in a Shiite arc that is going to stretch from Lebanon across Iraq and Syria to Iran, is an essential component of that Shiite-dominated arc. And the Iranians will do everything possible to keep the Assad regime in power, and they're proving it. While we are seeing political defections, and while we're seeing a much greater capacity by the Free Syrian forces to inflict significant damage on the regime, the regime troops are clearly fatigued, and you're seeing more and more Hezbollah and Iranian regular regiments enter the country.
And do you think that the fact that the Saudis are taking the lead in terms of the Free Syrian Army, that is that the entree for the Wahhabis and the Salafists and Al-Qaeda? You can't help feeling is a part of that mix.
Well, Al-Qaeda definitely is a part of the mix. There's no doubt, and they're coming in from like roaches. They're finding their way from all sorts of places in the Middle East, including Yemen, where they've been under duress from the Obama administration. The Saudis not only are providing official support to the Free Syrian Army, but there's a huge flow of money that is coming in from Saudi clerics who are using their own avenues to influence the internal Sunni eventual coalition or state that will emerge. So you have, in effect, the equivalent of a 1936 Spanish Civil War, where you have all the sides in the region taking up sides against each other. And Syria has become ground zero for every effort by the part of the Sunni versus the Shiite coalitions to essentially play for keeps.
But when we look at the Assad regime and its alliance with Iran and also with Hezbollah, again using the witch's brew analogy, Al-Qaeda is hardly any form of liberation. And I'm just astounded that how much we basically, I guess, because the U.S. doesn't really want to get involved in spite of what the Russians and the Chinese say, it seems pretty apparent that they have been doing minimal intervention and not even supplying arms, as far as I can tell. So, you know, there's a record of what the Saudis are about. I mean, their money helped to form the Taliban and kept them going. They've had a profound effect in radicalizing Pakistan, and they spent a lot of money in the elections in Egypt. The Salafist party that came in second in the parliamentary elections came out of nowhere, largely because of Saudi money. They have an agenda. It's extremely reactionary.
Well, not only that, but we have to understand that the most significant component of the Sunni opposition in Syria is composed of the Muslim Brotherhood. Most people forget, and they shouldn't forget, that the Assad family has engaged in an eternal war against the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria. In 1982, when the Brotherhood rose up in revolt against the father, Hafez al-Assad, he surrounded the city of Hama, which has been the site of a lot of fighting recently, and mowed down 20,000 people in order to get rid of the Brotherhood once and for all. The remnants were exiled, and now the remnants constitute a significant part of the Free Syrian Army and the leadership of the Syrian National Council.
So it's a little odd and ironic, isn't it, Ambassador Ginsburg, that we've been knocking off secular Arab regimes, albeit extremely distasteful ones, and they're being replaced in part by religious regimes.
You're going to see, and this is why I felt that the situation in Syria was so important strategically for the United States and why I believe the administration has abdicated its strategic foreign policy responsibility for political reasons and not done more without putting boots on the ground. I'm not in favor of putting boots on the ground, without doing more to influence the internal political evolution of the country, of Syria, by engaging many of the sectarian leadership in the country. You've got to understand, Syria is one of the few countries in that part of the world that has a significant number of interreligious minorities, and it has a Yugoslavian flavor to it.
Well, the Christians are already, they've been aligning themselves, they're only 10%, but they've been aligning themselves with Assad purely because they fear the very specter of an al-Qaeda type fundamentalist Islamic purge.
Well, al-Qaeda is, like any other terrorist organization, sees an opportunistic possibility of influence events inside Syria. And they have already been operating, as you know, next door in Iraq. There's been a resumption of sectarian strife in Iraq that most Americans would just as soon forget. But as soon as our troops got out, and those of us who understand Iraq realize that we've left in charge a prime minister who is slowly but surely becoming a puppet of the Iranian government, we more or less will wake up and realize that we got rid of Saddam only to in effect drop Iraq into the lap of the Iranians.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, the former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He served as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, and he serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense, a Special Operations Command, and an advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. He has a new article at the Huffington Post, "Obama's Syrian Red Line is No Red Light to Hezbollah or Iran." Let's just turn this to Israel, Ambassador Ginsburg, because the press over there is abuzz with speculation that Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Barak are determined to attack Iran before the U.S. elections. That seems to be the gist of the speculation, which is at a sort of fever pitch now. It's very hard to understand, and I believe there's the press in Israel is reporting that there's a lot of resistance to this from the defense and intelligence professionals, I think in part because this would be a huge reprieve, would it not, for the Assads, for Hezbollah, and for Iran if Israel were to attack Iran and take and basically take the, in effect, with the Assads on the ropes, as at this moment, that situation would reverse itself.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The Israelis have their own timetable. There's clearly significant, unprecedented public disagreement inside the Israeli military and political establishment over the consequences and effectiveness of an Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear installations, particularly without being certain what the United States would do in the event of an Israeli attack, because the consequences strategically to Israel and the United States are significant, as well as to the average American who will wind up having to pay at the pump for that type of consequence of the Straits of Hormuz closing. But let's also be realistic. The Israelis have a completely different sense of their exposure and vulnerability to Iran than we do. And we cannot, and the United States cannot, in effect, put a complete clamp on how Israel is going to act or not act in the face of Iran's continuing provocations and threats against it. I mean, just the other day, it's not as if the Iranians are trying to keep the situation from getting worse. Just the other day, Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, declared that Israel is a cancer in the world and it needs to be eradicated. Well, when you hear those statements, you know, what do you do if you're an Israeli prime minister? I'm not suggesting, by the way, by my comments, that I support the idea of an attack, given the fact that I understand how the consequences would play out to Israel and the rest of the region. But let's also give the Israelis some slack in understanding that they are dealing with a completely different framework of reference than we are.
So just back to your article in the Huffington Post, Ambassador Ginsburg, Obama's Syrian red line is no red light to Hezbollah or Iran. Just explain that kind of worst-case scenario that could happen in terms of these chemical arsenals. And I spoke yesterday to one of the former UN special weapons inspectors in Iraq at the Monterey Institute, Ray Zelinskas, and he said there's 24 sites, and presumably the U.S. has overheads and drones looking at this stuff, but it's pretty hard to watch all of them, and it's possible, as you've suggested, that they could be transferred into the hands of Hezbollah and the Iranians, and where the Assad regime may get some kind of deniability on their use. How would that scenario play out?
Well, that's the worst-case scenario, with one added wrinkle, that given the lawlessness and the breakdown of civil authority and the defections of Syrian military forces, there's no telling who would wind up using chemical weapons first. Let's just suppose a significant Syrian battalion decides to defect that's overseeing the WMD stockpile in the city outside of Aleppo, and they wind up using that weapon against some of the Syrian forces. That is the Assad forces. Well, what happens next? Who do you blame? What do you do? Does the United States act? There are so many different scenarios that it's scary, because in the end, as none of us really know how much they have, anyone who essentially claims publicly that they know how many WMD sites there are is probably guessing at best. But let's be real. They have dispersed huge stockpiles of WMD all over the country. And who knows, as the Assad regime loses its grip on power outside of Damascus, who's going to wind up being responsible for their first use? It is what has scared those of us who've watched Syria from the beginning of this revolt, and for the life of us could not understand why the West was not being more actively involved in trying to do more to prevent this situation and this scenario from emerging.
And there's also the other aspect, right, you mentioned in your article, of the possibility of just pure criminality, of selling
some
of this
stuff. Well, you have to understand that inside, just think of what's going on inside a town or a village in Syria. You have criminal gangs kidnapping people. You have criminal gangs extorting money. You have Sunni clerics giving money to al-Qaeda to buy weapons and to buy medicine. You have free Syrian forces trying to gain control over the population. And you have a population that is increasingly despondent, desperately in need of medical and humanitarian relief, and not getting anything. So where do you think these people are going to go? They're going to go to the first person who can offer them a bandage or portable water.
So given that you're a special advisor to the Department of Defense's Special Operations Command, the New York Times carried a story yesterday saying that the only way that the U.S. has a rapid response team that's capable and trained of going in and securing chemical weapons, are they anywhere near being deployed?
I really don't know. I wouldn't know, and I wouldn't even suggest to you that I know.
Sure. If you did know, you probably shouldn't tell me anyway. But.
Well, I won't go there. But suffice to say that when Pakistan's nuclear arsenal is becoming increasingly unstable in terms of security, I know the United States has contingency plans for that. But remember, Syria is a big country, and if we drop troops into Syria, well, who the hell knows what the Russians are going to do next after that?
Or the Chinese?
Well, they
won't do anything, but they're certainly.
I'm worried more about the Russians than I am about the Chinese, because the Chinese don't have troops on the ground in Syria. The Russians do.
Well, again, we get back to the witch's brew, I suppose, and your bottom line, though, appears to be that the U.S. has not been sufficiently involved, allowing the Saudis to introduce their extremist elements, and had we been involved in terms of the opposition, we may have some sway or influence over the post Assad regime.
We basically said to the Saudis and to the Turks and to the Israelis, we're turning our back on this one, baby, and it's an inconvenience to us right now. This is now several months ago. And the Saudis said, fine. And the Qataris, who are, by the way, just as active as the Saudis in this, also said, fine. The Turks have lurched from being involved to not being involved. So there hasn't been really any American or Western leadership to help bring a break and to coordinate a strategy. That will be the legacy, more or less, of the Obama administration's policy on Syria.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here, Ambassador Mark Ginsburg.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Ian.
Good to talk to you again. Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who's a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He served as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, and he serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense Special Operations Command and an advisor to the U.S. Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. He has a new article in the Huffington Post, Obama's Syrian Red Line is No Red Light to Hezbollah or Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back speaking with Robert Naiman about the Assange asylum and what the press aren't reporting or should be reporting about Julian Assange's fate.